Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we will be talking about the Syrian crisis and the growing tensions between the United States, Syria, and Russia. My guest, visiting at Fordham University in New York City, is Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst for 27 years under seven president administrations, from John F. Kennedy to George H.W. Bush. And among his duties were preparing the president's daily brief, which is a one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. He was responsible for the analysis of Soviet intelligence regarding Vietnam and served as the assistant national intelligence officer for Western Europe. And since retiring, Ray has been a vocal peace activist and journalist and helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals Sanity, or VIPS, to expose the way intelligence was falsified to justify war on Iraq, and the Sam Adams Association for Integrity Intelligence. He also works with Tell the World, an ecumenical Catholic publishing house. Ray's opinion pieces appear in many leading news sources, and he holds degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham University, an MA in Russian history, and is a graduate from Harvard Business School, and has a certificate in theology from Georgetown University. His website is raymcgovern.com, and more of his writings can be found on consortiumnews.com. Let's have you with us today, Ray. We're confused, and rightly so. On the one hand, some of the more, liberal, or at least what has historically been perceived as liberal media, such as Democracy Now!, have come out first supporting the intervention in Libya and then in Syria. In fact, just on a recent program, Julian Assange was, from my interpretation, challenged and almost excoriated, as if he was the reason that Trump became president, much like the left came out against Ralph Nader, saying that he was the reason that George Bush became president, which, in point of fact, through proper and honest and accurate analysis, was the case. Because those people who didn't like, Al Gore, wouldn't have voted for Al Gore. In any case, so you have a lot of the left, or what has the new contemporary left, which is also acting more like a mouthpiece for the Democratic National Committee and spokespersons for Hillary Clinton or the George Soros version of liberal in America, stating that the entire election was a fraud because Russia hacked into the DNC, stole the emails, then leaked them to Julian Assange. So they're saying that Assange was complicit, and that had that not happened, then the rightful president would have been Hillary Clinton. And so the American media has, by and large, supported that talking point over and over again, hammering at Russia as the person behind the scenes controlling everything. On the other hand, with this new revelation that there were civilians in Syria who were killed, about 90 deaths more or less, there's a universal outrage in the media, and both the left and right, including Hillary Clinton, who went on the record saying it was sarin gas, are condemning Assad and giving the green light. And you know that you're on the neocon side when the most powerful neocon family in America, the Kagans, praise you, and did so in the Washington Post, but said it was only, for all intents and purposes, a good first step. Needless to say, the average American is not able to put all this together. It's just too complicated, and especially if they don't have a background in intelligence. So, Ray, of the different scenarios being released by the White House, that the Syrian army intentionally carried out the attack with Russia's knowledge because they believed it was an area where Syrian forces did not have a strong control. Or, as others have said, the Syrians bombed an al-Qaeda-controlled weapons depot that happened to have been storing chemical weapons, and this is the stance that Russia and Syria hold. Or it might have been a false flag. Or it might have been ISIS. So we have all these possibilities. But what we don't have, we do not have an independent, professionally and properly done analysis of the forensic evidence with people on the ground giving feedback to say, here's what we believe to the best of our knowledge happened. You're in a better position than almost anyone else to know what we know up to this point. So please take us through this and tell us what you believe the evidence shows.
Sure. Well, Gary, thanks for the opportunity. We are fact-based intelligence analysts. We love documents such as the kind that Julian Assange serves up, unadulterated. He calls them pristine pure. And we like to have contacts with people who trust us, people on active duty, people below the general, below the level of the general. Now, we are in touch with people on the ground, so to speak. So we have more than a guess as to what happened here. And I can tell you from sources on the ground that we know and that trust us, this is the way it went down. There is a deconfliction arrangement. That is, about a year or more ago, it was August 2015, I believe, the Russians and we agreed that rather than run into each other, rather than shoot each other down, we ought to have a joint operation. We would be in Jordan and they would be in nearby. And we would deconflict the schedule of attacks on ISIS or on anyone else, even if it's rebels, even if it's, quote, moderate rebels of the kind that inhabit the place there called Idlib and have occupied that place for years. Okay, so this was a al-Qaeda. Let's make no mistake about this. This was a al-Qaeda in Syria stronghold. So it was fair game for bombing, because we and the Russians agree that al-Qaeda in Syria is not a very good operation. So we deconflicted this flight in terms of sharing information about what was there. The Russians knew, and we knew, that there were chemical weapons stored in this facility, which also was known to have conventional weapons. We knew chemical agents were there. We didn't know much more. And the Russians said to us, look, you know, this is pretty dangerous stuff. Please be aware that this is a pretty dangerous place for bombing. We went back and did a cost-benefit analysis. That is, we were talking to the U.S. Air Force. We said, well, you know, it doesn't look like it's much of a problem. And the next thing you knew, a Syrian aircraft was attacking this installation. And we know that the plume of chemicals went up, blew south with a very strong wind, and put about 80 people to death in this little village near Idlib. Now, was it intentional? No. They didn't know that these chemicals were there in such strength that if they hit them this way, that would happen. They did it anyway, or they did it out of ignorance as well as recklessness, and that's what happened. So the big thing that Americans need to know is that when President Trump talked about doing a retaliation for what he said was, quote, a chemical weapons attack, end quote, on Syrian civilians in southern Idlib province, that is not true, and he knows it's not true. So the question is, what explains why he decided to attack that, you know, with those 59 Tomahawk missiles, each one of which costs $1,400,000. Well, that's the mystery here. The U.S. people on the ground knew what had happened. They knew that this place was struck. They knew that the cloud went up and killed those people in that village. What we don't know, that is what I don't know and my friends and veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, is how high that word went. It's not, there's a lot of precedent for people on the ground fearing that if they told the truth, the White House would not be quite happy with that. So it's not clear whether the general in charge of that area told CENTCOM, the command in Tampa, which has overall purview, or whether General Voigt told his boss, General Matt, or former General Mattis, or whether the president was fully informed that, look, this was a mistake, that to speak about a, quote, chemical weapons attack is very, very misleading. Actually, it approaches a lie. He did it anyway. Now, why did he do it? Well, the first possibility, of course, is that they misinformed him, that he didn't really know what went down. They just showed him pictures of babies being killed and so forth, and he had an emotional reaction to that. That's a possibility. You know, everything's possible, and that presidents are as emotional as other people. The other thing is that he is under such pressure now by what you mentioned before, Gary, this witch hunt, this very calculated offensive to make sure, number one, that he's seen as the illegitimate pretender to the throne, to make Americans think that if it weren't for the Russians, those clever Russians that hack all these kinds of things, that Trump would never be president, that Hillary was cheated out of the presidency by, guess who, the Russians. Now, all I could say about the Idlib attack is that it's thoroughly dishonest for the United States to keep saying that this was a chemical weapons attack. Our U.S. Army contacts in the area have told us this is not what happened. Now, whether they told the general, whether the general told other generals, and they told the defense secretary, Mad Dog Mattis. Curious, isn't it, that he sort of is proud of that moniker. And whether they told the president, I just don't know. But it's altogether conceivable that the president was proceeding on incomplete, perhaps even distorted information, buttressed by these emotional pictures of children being killed. No one shows them the children that are being killed in Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya. So that's neither here nor there, but it's really quite curious that they would do this. Now, you mentioned the possibility that Trump is facing down what is called the deep state, the security services, what we Russian or Soviet specialists used to call the organy государственной безопасности, which means the organs of state security. Okay, that's the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, all these three-letter agencies who have doubled in power since 9/11. Now, that is real, Gary. I can tell you that is real. And there's been lots of evidence of that. But never had I had this kind of evidence. And I'll conclude with this, just because there's lots to discuss here, but how real is it? Well, here's Chuck Schumer, minority leader in the Senate, a senator from up here in New York, where I happen to be, and he's on Rachel Maddow. It's about six weeks ago, and he says to Rachel, you know, Rachel, I used to think Trump is a pretty smart guy, but he's done something very foolish. And Rachel says, oh, really? What's that? Well, he's taken on the CIA. And the CIA, well, they have six ways to Sunday to get him. And he doesn't realize that? I'm afraid I have to conclude that I thought he was a really smart businessman, but he's done something very foolish, Rachel, very foolish. Now, here's a sign of the times. What did Rachel say? What would you have said, Gary? What would I have said? Are you saying, Senator Schumer, that the President of the United States ought to be afraid of the CIA, and if he isn't, that's a very foolish way to behave? Is that what you're saying? But instead, well, I wasn't watching it. I imagine she said, oh, now we have to go to break or something, but she didn't follow up with that obvious question. So what am I saying here? I'm saying he's the minority in the Senate. He is saying something that's atypically candid, but he was very serious about it. And it's a reflection of the fact that John Brennan, who's an alumnus of this place, Fordham University, which I am as well, that he had incredible power under Senator Obama running for office and then President Obama for 8 full years. And when you look at all this hacking business and the whole story that's coming out about the Russians hacking and the Russians winning the election for Donald Trump, well, there's a eminence église behind all this. I won't tell you how his whole name is. His initials are John Brennan, and I can show how from the very earliest time he joined the Obama campaign in June of 2008 at a time when Obama was saying, "This is ridiculous. This legislation to hold the giant telecom communications harmless for infringing upon our rights under the Fourth Amendment, breaking all kinds of laws. This is terrible. I'll never vote for that." That was May. Brennan joined in June, it could be campaign. In July, Senator Obama said, "You know, I changed my mind on that bill. I think we ought to, I mean, these telecoms are doing great patriotic duty. I'm going to vote to hold them harmless." Well, that wasn't a big thing, but it stuck in my craw, Gary. It was the first signal that, whoops, Obama is under some sort of other influence now. And it was only later when I tracked the time that Brennan joined the campaign that it was, you know, you can't argue post hoc, ergo propter hoc. At least I learned that at Fordham. Just because something comes after something else doesn't necessarily mean it's because of it. But the temporal sequence is very, very, very obvious. And, you know, most people don't know this, but I'll adduce this one more example because people should know about it. You recall, Gary, that the Senate Intelligence Committee, under a deal worked out by then CIA Director Leon Panetta and the White House, they worked out a deal where the Senate investigators would get access to raw documentary cable traffic and other memos that the CIA had produced. Now, when did that happen and why? It happened right after the CIA took it upon itself to destroy some 90 videotapes of these harsh interrogations. People were justifiably upset by that. And so Senator Feinstein on the Senate Intelligence Committee was insisting on getting access to what the CIA traffic was on these kinds of horrible things, you know, the kidnapping and then the torture, all this kind of stuff. So she got access. And after 4 years, these young people that she had working for her determined not only that the CIA was using heinous things like, rectal hydration. I mean, for no medical reason at all. All kinds of hideous torture techniques. And worse still, the cable traffic could not show one instance in which it, quote, worked. In other words, all this talk about, yeah, but it's giving us good intelligence, was shown to be a bald-faced lie. Now, why am I saying all this? Well, I'm saying all this because, as you can imagine, the liars that had promised us on a stack of Bibles that this was very necessary for our defense and was protecting us against terrorism, John Brennan first and foremost, they didn't want this thing published. Hello, hello, no big surprise there. Now, it came down to the end of the Democratic control of the Senate. We're talking the end of 2014. There was going to change. The Senate had been taken over by Republicans. And Feinstein had this redacted executive summary, very big one, that had been vetted by the CIA and sort of prepared for publication, but there was resistance to it, and they wanted to wait until the Republicans took over the Senate so that there would be no Mrs. Feinstein to be so sanctimonious about this torture, okay? So what happened? Well, two things. John Brennan had a very, very powerful friend. His name was Barack Obama. He sent this fellow McDonough, who was one of his satraps, to every session, every declassification session. He sent McDonough to make sure that this thing would never appear. Now, Dianne Feinstein also had a very big supporter. That was Harry Reid, the minority leader in the Senate, majority leader in the Senate at that time. And he called up Obama and he said, Mr. President, I just can't, for the life of me, I can't figure why you would not want the American people to know the heinous things that happened here, and more important, the fact that it never did any good, never caused any intelligence to come out to make us more secure. Why are you doing that? And Obama says, well, it's most security. These are sensitive sources and methods, and we have it. And Harry Reid said to him, Mr. President, I just wish you could hear yourself. He said, I'm going to support Senator Feinstein. We're going to get that thing out. Now, what happened? They weren't going to prevail. It got to be December, okay? The Congress was about to adjourn. But Mark Udall, a prominent senator on the Senate Intelligence Committee, lost his bid for re-election. And he felt strongly. He and Ron Wyden from Oregon, they felt strongly about, thank God, at least two senators, and Feinstein, three senators felt strongly about torture, right, and about the good work that these four young investigators had done. And so Wyden made it be known that since he had nothing to lose, he was going to read the executive summary of this torture report on the floor of the Senate, and it would get out there into the congressional record. And he would be held harmless for that because the senator is entitled to do that. They don't usually do it, of course. It was done with the Pentagon Papers. Anyhow, that was the threat. So Feinstein went to the president and said, look, Mr. President, I don't know why you're resisting this. I don't know what kind of hold Brennan has over you. But if you don't release this the normal way, Senator Wyden's going to read this from the floor of the Senate. And it was only then, that President Obama said, oh, okay, I guess we ought to just release it. And when that came out, it was just devastating. But it did not get the appropriate play in our major media, which, for some strange reason, seems to be very defending of the organs of state security, if I can use that Soviet moniker.
I appreciate the depth of your answer there. Thank you. From your research, is there any credibility or truth to the reports in the mainstream American, European, and Israeli media that Russia has set a red line upon further U.S. military aggression against the Assad government and military, and that Russia would in some way retaliate? If not, then how do you explain it, aside from Washington trying to fabricate the image of Russia threatening the United States to win public support for a far more dire confrontation in the future?
Good question, Gary. Yesterday, we prepared our veteran intelligence professionals for sanity memorandum for the president. It's available today online. And we were dealing with this report. It was Reuters, of all places, and it just didn't sound right to us. And so we investigated it. It's one of these fake news reports, okay? Now, it's hard to figure out exactly who was behind it, but that is spurious information, and we kind of could sense that from the beginning, Gary, because the Russians don't do these things publicly, they do them privately, okay? Now, will the Russians react? Yes, they will react. It all depends on what happens this evening and tomorrow with Rex Tillerson, our new Secretary of State, in Moscow. The gauntlet has been thrown down. The Russians know what went down in that deconflicting arrangement, namely that we talked about what was in those bunkers and so forth. And immediately, when we warned the Russians that we were going to strike the air base, at which, incidentally, there were 10, 20, 30 Russian servicemen based, we decided we'd give them some forewarning. Now, there was a channel set up under the agreement for this deconflicting arrangement, whereby we would use this channel to alert people. Now, it's the middle of the night, okay? And a routine message was sent to the Russians, and they didn't treat it with much priority, and neither did we. And so rather than 2 hours of notice, they got about an hour and 15 minutes, just enough time to get their personnel out of there. They were livid about that. And the first thing they did in their reaction was to say, okay, that's it. We're not going to maintain this charade of deconflicting things. We can't make this work in any sensible way. We do have ways. We have a hotline or equivalent to the general staff, Joint Chiefs of Staff. We'll use that in emergencies, but this thing is passé, and we're not going to use that anymore. Now, we hear from our sources on the ground that they're still answering the phone, okay? So a lot of this is just to show their peak, their disappointment that they were given such little notice. But we're back in a situation, Gary, that existed 6 months ago now. The Russians had some reasonable hope that, given all the things that Trump had been saying, that as a reasonable businessman, he'd start dealing with the Russians, that there were no intractable problems here, that Putin and he could work things out. Well, back last September, and this is really important for Americans to know, the fruit of 11 months of haggling, of negotiation, between our Secretary of State, John Kerry, and the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, bore fruit. On the 9th of September, there was a ceasefire agreement which allowed the really bad guys to get out of Aleppo, and we would not bomb them. They'd just get out on these buses and so forth, and there would be a ceasefire. That went into effect, as I say, concluded on the 9th, into effect on the 12th. Now, on the 17th of September, this is all last year, the United States Air Force bombed fixed Syrian army positions in this contested area, positions that the Syrian army had occupied for months and months and months, killed between 74 and 84 Syrian soldiers, wounded over 100, scuttled the ceasefire. Now, that was a big shock, because Obama and Putin personally had overseen those negotiations and had given their personal chop on it, okay? They said, yes, this is an agreement between you and me, Putin and Obama. So they were shocked. And the Russians said, look, you know, Mr. Kerry, we think, is acting in good faith. We don't know why the Department of Defense did these things. But, you know, the upshot of it is that we have to conclude that there are people in Washington who don't really think the president is commander-in-chief. They take these things into their own hands. And so, this is the warning. Now, they got the spokesperson for the Ministry of Defense up, it's Kondrashov. And he says, look, we just want to let you know that from now on, we're talking October 7th, it was, we'll let you know that we're going to shoot down anything that flies over Syria, anything that is not pre-announced, anything that's not vetted with us in this deconfliction arrangement, we're going to shoot down. Now, please, no surprises here. We know that you have these stealth aircraft. We're going to shoot them down, too. And the last thing I'll say, he said, was, you know, there won't be time for us to identify the origin of the aircraft. We're just going to shoot it down. Whoa. So the Russians imposed a no-fly zone over Syria in reaction to the fact that our Air Force could not be trusted to abide by the ceasefire worked out by Putin and Obama personally. Now, things didn't get much worse than that. God help us, they shouldn't have. And the Russians waited for the election to happen. And they thought, well, there's a reasonable chance that Putin might turn out to be somebody they could deal with. They had, I know they had, because I've been watching Russian leaders for 55 years, if you can believe it, since I decided to major in Russian right up here at Fordham. They had real doubts about this cluck, Trump. You know, they visualize Putin and his associates, you know, the generals and everybody sitting around the table, and Putin saying, say, in September, October of last year, wow, what an interesting campaign. Here's this one guy, he's unpredictable. And he's part of it. He brags about being unpredictable. And not only that, but he takes very rash action at any real or just imagined slight. Oh, this is just the guy I want to have with his finger on the nuclear codes across the ocean. Give me a break. There's no, you know, anybody who knows anything about how Russian leaders look at their strategic objectives, which is to keep Russia safe, okay, would say that if Putin was rooting for Trump, well, that's a very odd Russian or Soviet leader. The unpredictability, well, it's been proven, hasn't it, last week or so, is the thing they fear most. So this whole, you know, we call that a syllogism, at least that's what I learned here in Fordham, is the main premise. The main premise is that the Russians really wanted Trump to win. If that is put by the wayside, which I think it should be, then the whole thing falls apart. Then you don't get a minor premise to say that the Russians do everything they could, including hacking, to make sure Hillary loses, with the conclusion, ah, yes, they prefer Trump, and Trump is going to win. And that's another story, and we can get into it if you like, but I feel like I'm monopolizing the conversation here, Gary. Let me pause for a second in case you'd like to interject.
I would. Thank you, Ray. Two very important and perhaps related issues that need to be addressed that are occurring right now within the Trump administration. First is the gradual takeover of Trump's foreign policy and national security by our old friends, the neocons, who simply won't go away, no matter how many times they have been wrong, which is forever, and no matter how many times their problems cause people to die, innocent people, they have no sense of humility. They take no responsibility for it. We've seen Bannon ousted from the Security Council just days before the chemical weapons episode. By the way, Bannon, as this audience should know, is an isolationist who does not embrace the neocon imperialist doctrine in the Middle East and against Russia and China. And second, there is a dramatic shift in Trump's posturing towards Putin compared to the rhetoric he campaigned, which was more moderate and sought cooperation and compromise. It also appears that Obama's deal with Iran is on the table to be axed. So please explain these two recent developments and how are they both related? And who is it among the neocon contingent that is now winning Trump's ear?
Well, those are all good questions, Gary. And, you know, I never thought I would consider Bannon the lesser of two evils. But compared to Robert Kagan and his wife, Victoria Nuland, who orchestrated the coup on Russia's doorstep in Kiev in February of 2014, compared to that crowd, Bannon at least wanted to put America first. At least he had some sort of sense. And by all reports, he was against this flailing out with these Tomahawk missiles. So Yeah, there is some sort of palace coup going on here. People have been removed, and it doesn't look really good for a sensible foreign policy. Kagan and all the other people who are responsible for untold suffering in this world. He was a big, big devotee of attacking Iraq. The same with Libya. The same with Afghanistan and now Syria. They don't disguise what they wish for us. What they wish for us is to dominate everyone. And none of them, and I'd say advisedly, almost none of them have had any military experience. Those of us who have served, those of us who know what war is like, we have a different attitude toward these things. And maybe I'll just interject here that most Americans have no idea of, well, for example, World War II and what that meant to Russia. I was alive for all of World War II, just a young boy. But I remember, you know, the first 20 years of my life were conditioned by the war and then the immediate after war. No one told me how many people Russia lost in the war. They were all commies. We had to be dividing, be careful about them. Joe McCarthy was around. They were going to take over the world. How many people did Russia lose in World War II? Well, I learned that, not in graduate school, mind you, but later, you're doing some research. Well, Putin says they lost 25 million. The historians say 27 million. Just to compare, the U.S. losses were about 430,000, not to say that each and every one of those precious souls shouldn't have been lost to the war, but if you look at how the Russians look at the world and their experience, you know, some of them are still around. I went over and I celebrated the meeting on the Elbe when U.S. forces and Soviet forces got together at the end of the war. What a joyous celebration that was. There are great photos of that. And I went over to Moscow to help celebrate that. Why? Well, because the Obama administration was not taking very seriously the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. Most Americans think, and this is encouraged by the White House, they think that the war really was won by the Normandy invasion. Now, as good as that was, that came after the Russians had beat back the German forces out of Ukraine back into Central Europe, and they had them on the run. Again, no denigrating our contribution to that, but that was, June of 44. The Russians have been slugging it out ever since Hitler invaded them in 41. So what I'm saying here now is that a person like Vladimir Putin, now, he was not born during the war or before it, but his brother was. His brother was in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. He died. What did he die of? I don't know, but I do know a million people from St. Petersburg died in the 900-day siege of Leningrad by the Nazi troops. They were eating dogs. Many of them just perished. I've been there. It's either big mounds of graves. So what I'm saying, I say when you grow up in a family where your big brother starves to death or whatever happened to him, you get a different outlook on life. And what we should be aware of is that the Russians have experienced the war in a way we never have, and God help us, I hope we never will. They were destroyed. So was Germany. So was France and parts of Britain. We were not. And so after World War II, we were the sole superpower in the world, and our whole policy has been devised in such a way as to keep that that superiority. But the Russians, you know, they're trying to understand what makes us tick. They don't know why we mounted a coup in Kiev, and they really don't know what we're doing in Syria. And I dare say, Gary, that not many Americans know what we're doing in Syria. And if I could take another minute, I'll tell you.
Please
okay,
do.
I'll tell you. you know, it's what the Germans call a Rätsel. It's a puzzle is the word, yeah. People ask me, Why did President Obama 6 years ago say Bashar al-Assad has to go? Why did Hillary Clinton keep saying Bashar al-Assad has to go? Why does Nikki Haley say Bashar al-Assad has to go? Then the next day she says, well, we'll let him hang around long, but now he has to go again. Why? What kind of a threat is Bashar al-Assad to the United States of America? The answer is zero. So, how do you explain this? How do you explain our latching on to what started out as a bona fide Arab Spring in Syria and putting all kinds of arms, weapons, and other support into these groups financed and supported also by the Saudis, by the Turks, by the Qataris? Why do we do all that? Well, there's an answer that I can deduce, and it's this. Not made out of thin air. In 2013, when Obama resisted the advice of all his national security advisors to do what Trump just did last week, that is, shock and awe against Syria, a new bureau chief, New York Times bureau chief in Jerusalem, Jody Ruderman was her name, and she said, you know, maybe I could have talked to Israeli officials to find out their take on all this, you know. And so she went and she talked to several Israeli officials, active and retired. And she said, what's your preferred outcome in Syria? Now, be aware, this is several years into the hostilities, 2013. So now, Alon Pincus, who had been consul general for Israel in New York, he said, now, Jody, this doesn't sound really good, but I'm going to, you know, be frank with you. Our preferred outcome is no outcome. And she said, Alon, traduisez, s'il vous plaît, no outcome? What do you mean, no outcome? He said, well, again, I told you, Joy, it does sound very good, not very humanitarian, but we look at it as sort of a playoff game where you don't want either team to win. You don't want either team to lose either. As long as the bloodbath continues, as long as Shia and Sunni are at each other's throats, not only in Syria, but throughout the whole region, quote, Israel has nothing to fear from Syria, period, end quote. Now, would the people running our policies toward that part of the world pretty much sympathetic to that Israeli view? You bet your bonnet on that. Look at Hillary Clinton's emails where she talks about how she needs to support Israel in any way that it really, really desires. And if it's afraid of Bashar al-Assad, and there is, well, it's a stretch to say they're afraid of him with these nukes that they have, but they need Syria in the sense that Hezbollah, the Shia Muslim group that actually is part of the government now in Lebanon, and with whom the Israelis fought a pitched battle, a small war, about 5 years ago, to a draw, okay? Only time that the Israelis have been fought to a draw, any time that I can remember. Okay, now Hezbollah is supplied mostly by Iran and from some other folks. And how do they get their supplies? Well, they have to travel over a country called Syria. So from Israel's point of view, they're near abroad, that is Syria and other nearby countries, has a specific threat to the extent that it's easy enough to get through Syria to resupply Hezbollah in Lebanon until the next time Israel strikes at southern Lebanon, they're going to get another bloody nose like they did 5 years ago. So there's the immediate objective, but the general geopolitical objective is to keep Sunni and Shia at each other's throats because, well, look at the situation. Israel hasn't been threatened by either side anytime soon, and they're playing this game very adroitly. Now, Jody Ruderman wrote that up. How do I know that? Because it appeared on page one of the New York Times on September 6th, 2013. That is the only time I have seen an objective report on Israel's outlook on what really care, what they really care about in Syria, i.e., no outcome is their preferred outcome. Now, how did that get by the New York Times censors? Well, I happen to know that the muckety-mucks, as my grandmother used to call them, they go out to the Hamptons on Labor Day, and they spend the week with the nice little martinis and so forth. The only thing I can figure, Gary, is that all the censors were sipping martinis, and this one slipped through the censors. There hasn't been anything like it before or since, but that's the real deal. Israel's preferred outcome is no outcome, and I have to tell you, with 400,000 Syrians dead, with every other person dislodged, with millions in exodus or refugees, I mean, that's a pretty sorry state of affairs, and it reinforces what George Washington, our first president, warned against. That is what he called a passionate attachment to the strategic objectives of another country, where those strategic objectives are not really identical, but just seem to be so because of political realities. That's the case we have with the neocons, who not only have these imperial ambitions, but also, and just as important, well, that way I put it is that they have great difficulty distinguishing between what they perceive to be Israel's interests and the interests of the United States. Now, I don't hold that against them in an objective view. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. I just don't think they should be running United States policy. And they have been. And my God, it looks like they're coming back into power.
Okay, final question for you. And it may seem a little off topic, but it isn't. I'll summarize a few of the points of research that I have been able to come up with. During more than 14 months where the United States and Obama said that he was going to actively go after the terrorist, the terrorists that we were not supporting, including al-Nusra and ISIS in Syria, I could not find where they had bombed a single oil convoy. The oil convoys, as we now know, were leaving from Turkey under the supervision of Erdogan's son, the head of Turkey, going into Syria and capturing a lot of its light oil, light crude, expensive, also going into Iraq and doing the same thing, bringing it back in to Turkey and then selling it on the black market for as little as $20 a barrel, substantially under market value. And giving that money also at that time to the different terrorist groups, depending upon where they were getting it. And at one point, it was anywhere from $1 million to $4 million a week to these terrorist organizations. That's just one source of their income. Russia comes in, and immediately you start seeing that they're bombing entire convoys. Now, these are not little convoys. As many as 12,000 trucks were reported to be engaged in this smuggling operation. So any satellite, any reconnaissance would have known this because that's not something you can hide. That's one point, that it was only after Russia entered that Syria stopped becoming, almost a failed state at that point. Also, it was Russia that got the United States to negotiate to get all of Syria's weapons of mass destruction, not which the United States then destroyed much of it in the North Atlantic. And separately, and this is important as well, we said that we were against terrorism and we wanted to fight the terrorist. In fact, everyone in the campaign, from Hillary Clinton every single Democrat and Republican leader, said the same thing. They're going to be tough on terrorists. And yet at the same time that we were, quote, tough on terrorists, it has now come out, including from the former top intelligence operative in Turkey, who worked heading the entire police and security apparatus of the capital, that they were training, arming, had a special hospital that was run by Erdogan's relatives for ISIS. So they would put ISIS into motion. They were being funded in turn by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait. And so we had most of the most powerful Arab nations supporting terrorists, funding terrorists, helping to recruit terrorists, and spreading their own particular form of Wahhabism, the most radical form of Islam. The United States was fully aware. In fact, once it came out that we had spent $500 million to train less than 50 of these so-called moderate terrorists, and later turned out moderate terrorists were not moderate at all. And then we end up seeing long caravans of ISIS using American vehicles, brand new vehicles and armored carriers and rifles. And the media did not challenge the administration at a single point, not once, because we went back and looked. Richard Gale, you know, we looked to see, did the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, did they ever challenge the United States for aiding and abetting the terrorists that we're supposedly going after? And it was only when Russia came in and started knocking out all of these different terrorist groups, and we got really angry because some of those terrorist groups they were knocking out were John McCain's favored terrorist groups. He actually posed for pictures with him, including the man who would later call himself the caliphate. And so what do you make of it when a media will not report as it should be, as others did during the Vietnam War, the truth of our engagement, and that we've been supporting different terrorist organizations there, and then telling the American people that we don't have money for you because we have to give it to these intelligence agencies, the Defense Department, CIA, to fight terrorists. Your final thoughts, please.
Sure. Well, this corruption, of course, is at the core of a lot of this. So is the, the incentive to keep wars going. Peace is very bad for business, Gary. You know that. War, tension, look how Raytheon stock went up as soon as we shot off those 59 Tomahawk missiles. So our generals also profit from war. They get another star, and they're in it for the duration, and they talk blithely. And anyone who has a sense of history just boggles at this. Petraeus and the others say, well, we're in for a 30 years war, 30 years war. Well, there was one of those. And it concluded with the Treaty of Westphalia, where the Europeans said, it's not such a good idea to go killing each other all the time. Let's honor national boundaries. Well, that being as it is, let me just address exactly what you're talking about. The explanation here is that our objective was to get rid of Assad. And that coincided with Saudi Arabia, with Turkey, with the United Arab Emirates, and with Qatar. That was our focus. And the Russians got really sick of that. They got really tired of that. Why? Because the Russians have skin in this game. There are thousands of terrorists from southern Russia being armed, equipped, trained, and getting really good practical experience in places like Syria, Iraq, southern Turkey. And so when Putin braced Obama at the end of September 2015 and said, look, Mr. President, we're not real impressed by your battle against terror in Syria, so you know that we've been bringing in aircraft and radar and all that. We're going to start using them day after tomorrow. Would really like to do this together. And if you would appoint Kerry and I'll appoint Lavrov, have them work out a deal here so at first we don't run into each other, we deconflict our flights, but then work something out. Now, long story is that they did work. How long? 11 months, okay? And in September, as I mentioned before, September of last year, they reached a ceasefire agreement, which was scuttled by our own military. And Kerry himself, in an interview with the Boston Globe, pretty much said it was Ash Carter and the Pentagon that subverted all my efforts for these 11 months and prevailed as they usually do. And so the hope here is that Americans can learn what's going on, and that goes to my final point. You mentioned the media. I've been in Washington for 55 years now. You see a lot of change in 55 years, Gary. But there's one change that dwarfs all the others in significance, and that is that we no longer have in any real sense, a free media. The fourth estate is dead. The good news, of course, is there's a fifth estate. It's in the ether. It comes down into my computer. The problem is that people my age, and even people younger than me, shy away from just learning how to press the right keys to find out what's really going on. They'd prefer to sit with a beer and watch what they think is news on TV. That is at the core of all this. And if the New York Times and the Washington Post are now applauding our president for doing the dumbest thing that he's done yet, that is, lash out with 59 Tomahawk missiles, then, you know, that shows something about who owns these media, who's profiteering from these wars and this tension. And in a word, the six main media corporations are pretty much minor business areas of places like GE that makes all its money on jet engines and not on its news operations. So the news operations serve the general purpose of the corporation. We don't get close to too objective information. So unless you tune in to consortiumnews.com or remagovern.com, says he very humbly, you may not know what's going on. There are other good sites, too. And it's not just gilding the lily. The fifth estate is real. It's just that we have to catch up. We have to resist the people of my generation. You know, we used to have toys that could break, you know, like they're made out of tin. And if you broke it, you broke it. That's it. You can't break a computer. And my grandchildren keep saying, Grandpa, just try it. You can't break it. And that would be my advice to the elders, people of my generation. Try it. You'd be amazed at how easy it is, how you can really get yourself well-informed to hold your argument in any kind of debate and educate your neighbors with respect to what's going on, because they believe all this stuff about Russia. It's so assiduously promoted by the mainstream media, and much of it is what the Germans call Quatsch, which means rubbish in English.
Ray, thank you once again for coming back on and informing us on the Syrian crisis and all the little nuance that the average person would not be aware of, because, as you said, the fourth estate is bankrupt in credibility, and the American public are catching on, and they are reaching out to other sources. We appreciate being on, Ray. Ray McGovern. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. I thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.